Then. In 1979, the Jenny station at the intersection of SR-32 and the Humboldt Road was still open, but it was staggering badly. OPEC took all the little ones out in the end. The mechanic and owner was Herbert Hugh Bossy, and on that particular day he was over in Lassburg getting his teeth looked after. A bear for his Snickers bars and RC Colas was Hugh Bossy. "No mech on duty because of toothache," said the sign taped in the window of the garage bay. The pump jockey was a high school dropout named Bradley Roach, barely out of his teens. This fellow, 22 years and untold thousands of beers later, would come along and kill the father of a boy who was not then born, crushing him against the side of a Fruithof box, turning him like a spindle, unrolling him like a noisemaker, spinning him almost skinless into the weeds, and leaving his bloody clothes inside out on the highway like a magic trick. But all that is in the yet-to-be. We are in the past now, in the magical land of then. At around 10 o'clock on a morning in July, Brad Roach was sitting in the office of the Jenny station with his feet up, reading Inside View. On the front was a picture of a flying saucer hovering ominously over the White House. The bell in the garage dinged as the tires of a vehicle rolled over the air hose on the tarmac. Brad looked up to see a car, the very one which would spend so many years in the darkness of Shed B, pull up to the second of the station's two pumps. That was the one labeled High Test. It was a beautiful midnight blue Buick, old. It had the big chrome grill and the portholes running up the sides, but in mint condition. The paint sparkled. The windshield sparkled. The chrome sweeping along the body sparkled. And even before the driver opened the door and got out, Bradley Roach knew there was something wrong with it. He just couldn't put his finger on what it was. He dropped his newspaper on the desk. He never would have been allowed to take it out of the desk drawer in the first place if the boss hadn't been over town paying for his sweet tooth, and got up just as the roadmaster's driver opened his door on the far side of the pumps and got out. It had rained heavily the night before, and the roads were still wet, hell, still underwater in some of the low places on the west side of Statler Township. But the sun had come out around 8 o'clock, and by 10 the day was both bright and warm. Nevertheless, the man who got out of the car was dressed in a black trench coat and a large black hat. "Looked like a spy in some old movie," Brad said to Ennis Rafferty an hour or so later, indulging in what was, for him, a flight of poetic fancy. The trench coat, in fact, was so long it nearly dragged on the puddly cement tarmac, and it billowed behind the Buick's driver as he strode toward the side of the station and the sound of Redfern Stream, which ran behind it. The stream had swelled wonderfully in the previous night's showers. Brad, assuming that the man in the black coat and floppy black hat was headed for the seat of convenience, called, "Bathroom door's open, mister. How much of this jet fuel you want?"
"Fill her up," the customer said.
He spoke in a voice Brad Roach didn't much like. What he told the responding officers later was that the guy sounded like he was talking through a mouth full of jelly. Brad was in a poetical mood for sure. Maybe Hugh being gone for the day had something to do with it.
"Check the Earl?" Brad asked.
By this time his customer had reached the corner of the little white station. Judging by how fast he was moving, Brad figured he had to offload some freight in a hurry. The guy paused, though, and turned toward Brad a little. Just enough for Brad to see a pallid, almost waxy crescent of cheek, a dark, almond-shaped eye with no discernible white in it, and a curl of lank black hair falling beside one oddly made ear. Brad remembered the ear best, remembered it with great clarity. Something about it disturbed him deeply, but he couldn't explain just what it was. At this point, Posey failed him. Melted, kind of like he'd been in a fire, seemed to be the best he could do.
"Oil's fine,"
the man in the black coat and hat said in his choked voice, and was gone around the corner in a final bat-like swirl of dark cloth. In addition to the quality of the voice, that unpleasant, mucusy sound, the man had an accent that made Brad Roach think of the old Rocky and Bullwinkle show, Boris Badenoff telling Natasha, "We must stop Moose und Squirrel." Brad went to the Buick, ambled down the side closest to the pumps. The driver had parked carelessly, leaving plenty of room between the car and the island, trailing one hand along the chrome swoop and the smooth paint job as he went. That touch was more admiring than impudent, although it might have had a bit of harmless impudence in it. Bradley was then a young man with a young man's high spirits. At the back, bending over the fuel hatch, he paused. The fuel hatch was there, but the rear license plate wasn't. There wasn't even a plate holder or screw holes where a plate would normally go. This made Bradley realize what had struck him as wrong as soon as he heard the ding-ding of the bell and looked up at the car for the first time. There was no inspection sticker. Well, no business of his if there was no plate on the back deck and no inspection sticker on the windshield. Either one of the local cops or a statey from Troop D just up the road would see the guy and nail him for it. Or they wouldn't. Either way, Brad Roach's job was to pump gas. He twirled the crank on the side of the high test pump to turn back the numbers, stuck the nozzle in the hole, and set the automatic feed. The bell inside the pump started to bing, and while it did, Brad walked up the driver's side of the Buick, completing the circuit. He looked through the left side windows as he went, and the car's interior struck him as singularly stark for what had been almost a luxury car back in the 50s. The seat upholstery was Wren Brown, and so was the fabric lining the inside of the roof. The back seat was empty. The front seat was empty. And there was nothing on the floor, not so much as a gum wrapper, let alone a map or a crumpled cigarette pack. The steering wheel looked like inlaid wood. Bradley wondered if that was the way they had come on this model, or if it was some kind of special option. Looked ritzy. And why was it so big? If it had had spokes sticking out of it, you would have thought it belonged on a millionaire's yacht. You'd have to spread your arms almost as wide as your chest just to grip it. Had to be some sort of custom job. And Brad didn't think it would be comfortable to handle on a long drive. Not a bit comfortable. Also, there was something funny about the dashboard. It looked like burled walnut and the chrome controls and little appliances. Heater, radio, clock. Looked all right. They were in the right places, anyway. And the ignition key was also in the right place. Trusting soul, ain't he? Brad thought. Yet there was something about the setup that was very much not right. Hard to say what, though. Brad strolled back around to the front of the car again, admiring the sneering chrome grill. It was all Buick, that grill. That part, at least, was dead on the money. And verifying that there was no inspection sticker. Not from PA or any place else. There were no stickers on the windshield at all. The Buick's owner was apparently not a member of AAA, the Elks, the Lions, or the Kiwanis. He did not support Pitt or Penn State, at least not to the extent of putting a decal on any of the Buick's windows, and his car wasn't protected by Mopar or good old Rusty Jones. Pretty cool car, just the same. Although the boss would have told him that his job wasn't to admire the rolling stock, but just to fill him fast. The Buick drank $7 worth of the good stuff before the feed cut off. That was a lot of gas in those days, when a gallon of high test could be purchased for 70 cents. Either the tank had been close to empty when the man in the black coat took the car out, or he'd driven it a far piece. Then Bradley decided that second idea had to be bullshit, because the roads were still wet, still brimming over in the dips, for God's sake. But there wasn't a single mud streak or splatter on the Buick's smooth blue hide. Not so much as a smear on those fat and luxy white walls, either. And to Bradley Roach, that seemed flat out impossible. It was nothing to him one way or the other, of course, but he could point out the lack of a valid inspection sticker. Might get him a tip. Enough for a six-pack, maybe. He was still 6 or 8 months from being able to buy legally, but there were ways and means if you were dedicated, and even then, in the early going, Bradley was dedicated. He went back to the office, sat down, picked up his inside view, and waited for the fellow in the black coat to come back. It was a damned hot day for a long coat like that, no doubt about it. But by then, Brad thought he had that part figured out. The man was an SKA, just a little different from the ones around Statler. From a sect that allowed car driving, it seemed. SKAs were what Bradley and his friends called the Amish. It stood for shit-kicking assholes. 15 minutes later, when Brad had finished reading We Have Been Visited by UFO expert Richard T. Rumsfeld, U.S. Army retired, and had given close attention to a blonde page four girl who appeared to be fly fishing a mountain stream in her bra and panties, Brad realized he was still waiting. The guy hadn't gone to make any nickel and dime deposit, it seemed. That guy was clearly a shithouse millionaire. Snickering, imagining the guy perched on the jakes under the rusty pipes, sitting there in the gloom. The single light bulb had burned out a month ago, and neither Bradley nor Hugh had gotten around to changing it yet. With his black coat puddled all around him and collecting mouse turds, Brad picked up his newspaper again. He turned to the joke page, which was good for another 10 minutes. Some of the jokes were so comical, Brad read them 3 and even 4 times. He dropped the paper back on the desk and looked at the clock over the door. Beyond it, at the pumps, the Buick Roadmaster sparkled in the sun. Almost half an hour had passed since its driver had cried, "Oil's fine," back over his shoulder in his strangly voice, and then disappeared down the side of the building in a fine swirl of black cloth. Was he an SKA? Did any of them drive cars? Brad didn't think so. The SKAs thought anything with an engine was the work of Satan, didn't they? Okay, so maybe he wasn't. But whatever he was, why wasn't he back? All at once, the image of that guy on the gloomy, discolored throne back there by the diesel pump didn't seem so funny. In his mind's eye, Brad could still see him sitting there with his coat puddled around him on the filthy linoleum and his pants down around his ankles. But now Brad saw him with his head down, his chin resting on his chest, his big hat, which didn't really look like an Amish hat at all, slewed forward over his eyes, not moving, not breathing, not shitting, but dead. Heart attack or brain trembleism or something like that. It was possible. If the goddamn king of rock and roll could croak while doing number two, anyone could. "Nah," Bradley Roach said softly. "Nah, that ain't. He wouldn't have. Nah." He picked up the paper, tried to read about the flying saucers that were keeping an eye on us, and couldn't convert the words into coherent thoughts. He put it down and looked out the door. The Buick was still there, shining in the sun. No sign of the driver. Half an hour. No, 35 minutes now. God dang. Another 5 minutes passed, and he found himself tearing strips off the newspaper and drifting them down to the wastebasket, where they formed piles of nervous confetti. "Fuck it," he said, and got to his feet. He went out the door and around the corner of the little white cinder block cube where he'd worked since dropping out of high school. The restrooms were down at the back, on the east side. Brad hadn't made up his mind if he should play it straight. "Mister, are you all right?" Or humorous. "Hey, mister, I got a firecracker if you need one." As it turned out, he got to deliver neither of these carefully crafted phrases. The men's room door had a loose latch and was apt to fly open in any strong puff of wind unless bolted shut from the inside. So Brad and Hugh always stuffed a piece of folded cardboard into the crack to keep the door shut when the restroom wasn't in use. If the man from the Buick had been inside the toilet, the fold of cardboard would either have been in there with him and probably left beside one of the sink's faucets while the man tended his business, or it would be lying on the small cement stoop at the foot of the door. This latter was usually the case, Brad later told Ennis Rafferty. He and Hugh were always putting that cardboard wedge back in its place after the customers left. They had to flush the toilet as well more often than not. People were careless about that when they were away from home. People were, as a rule, downright nasty when they were away from home. Right now, that cardboard wedge was poking out of the crack between the door and the jamb, just above the latch, exactly where it worked the best. All the same, Brad opened the door to check, catching the little cardboard wedge neatly as it fell. As neatly as he would learn to open a bottle of beer on the driver's side handle of his own Buick in later years. The little cubicle was empty, just as he'd known in his heart it would be. No sign that the toilet had been used. And there had been no sound of a flush as Brad sat in the office reading his paper. No beads of water on the rust-stained sides of the basin, either. It occurred to Brad then that the guy hadn't come around the side of the station to use the can, but to take a look at Redfern Stream, which was pretty enough to warrant a peek, or even a snap at the old Kodak from a passerby, running as it did, with the Statler Bluffs on its north side and all those willows up on top, spreading out green like a mermaid's hair. There was a poet in the boy, all right, a regular Dylan McYeats. But around back, there was no sign of the Buick's driver, either, only discarded auto parts and a couple of ancient tractor axles lying in the weeds like rusty bones. The stream was babbling at the top of its lungs, running broad and foamy. Its swelling would be a temporary condition, of course. Floods in western PA are spring events, as a rule. But that day, the normally sleepy Redfern was quite the torrent. Seeing how high the water was gave rise to a horrifying possibility in Bradley Roach's mind. He measured the steep slope down to the water. The grass was still wet with rain and probably god dang slippery, especially if an unsuspecting SKA came thee-in and thou-in along in shoes with slippery leather soles. As he considered this, the possibility hardened to a near certainty in his mind. Nothing else explained the unused shithouse and the car still waiting at the high test pump, all loaded and ready to go, keys still in the ignition. Old Mr. Buick Roadmaster had gone around back for a peek at the Redfern, had foolishly dared the embankment slope to get an even better look, and whoops, there goes your ball game. Bradley worked his own way down to the water's edge, slipping a couple of times in spite of his Georgia Giants, but not falling, always keeping near some hunk of junk he could grab if he did lose his footing. There was no sign of the man at the water's edge. But when Brad looked downstream, he saw something caught in the lee of a fallen birch about 200 yards from where he stood, bobbing up and down. Black! It could have been Mr. Buick Roadmaster's coat. Oh, shit, he said and hurried back to the office to call Troop D, which was at least 2 miles closer to his location than the local cop shop. And that was how...